And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's 52 weeks in a year, 365 days. Well, that's how long the Wild Side News has been traveling the Earth, bringing you the ongoing story of life on planet Earth. Yes, it's our first anniversary show, and we're glad to have you at the celebration. So put on your dancing boots as we get set to launch year two of the Wild Side News. This is Sydney Wildsmith, and welcome to the Wild Side News. Today we will cover the latest nature news, then talk with Jeff Jarvis with the BLM.
That's how this all began 1 year ago. Tomorrow begins the second year of the Wild Side News. It's been quite a journey. We've covered stories from frogs to dogs, Earth Day to the 100th birthday of Yellowstone Lodge. The wilderness was a big story as it celebrated its 40th anniversary. And in this past year, you've had the chance to visit over 20 national parks. As the year progressed, new voices were heard each week, and now the Wild Side News is, through the archives, the voice of the Earth. We shared a lot of concern about election 2004, and when it was over, we pushed on. We had a lot of fun along the way, cleaning up rivers, celebrating trails, learning to do field sketches, even helping to unearth a T-Rex. We've kept you informed of significant breaking news, as with our joint announcement by the Rainforest Action Network and the Bank of America. And of course, we've been there when the action was on the street. Remember our live interview with Lincoln Kareem and the Pale Male saga?
Pale Male, you look into his eyes and you get hooked. He's an animal, he's a bird, he's a hero. You look at him, you realize, this is someone true, man. This is not some celebrity who would, you know, fool around with some prostitute somewhere and disappoint you somewhere. This is a bird that's real. You look at him, you know there's no disappointment to come. He is a true hero. He's not a politician. He does his thing, you watch him, and you feel good deep inside of your heart. He is my hero. That is how I spend so much time on him. I take all my vacation I have. I just practically took time off from work indefinitely until this stuff is resolved. That's the kind of effect he has on me.
And we brought you the good news of its settlement. Every so often, we go in-depth to bring you stories and focus you almost never hear anywhere else, like our special oceans report from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Charles Kennell, Scripps director, who served on the Pew Oceans Commission, brought you the truth about our oceans. I'll always remember this moment.
The solving the global environmental issues that we see gradually accumulating will require a degree of human cooperation and interconnectedness that has not yet been seen.
We're working on it.
So are we.
Dr. Charles Kennell, thank you for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
Through the internet, we reach listeners around the world, and we will continue to do so on an expanded basis in the year ahead. I was honored to be able to bring Jane Goodall to all the children of the world as she addressed the International Children's Conference on the Environment.
I think I'm going to start off by giving you a greeting in chimpanzee. That really means just, hello, I'm Jane. You know, that's how they greet the morning.
And the Wild Side News went around the world, carried in the hearts and minds of kids who attended the conference.
I'm from Canada, New Brunswick, and Fredericton in New Brunswick.
My name is Jay Shaw. I'm from Kenya.
This is Christian. I'm from Michigan, United States.
Hi, this is Nicole. I'm from Tehran, Iran.
Now, the Wild Side News is growing. We recently launched the expanded special editions of the Wild Side News, presenting historic records of the voices who are shaping the earth. Within the last month, we have covered the debate that is still reshaping the environmental movement. Is environmentalism dead? And we painted the big picture as we featured voices from around the nation as the dream of energy independence takes shape through the united efforts of the Apollo Alliance. So, what lies ahead? We will, this year, bring you great news of significant breakthroughs in sustainability, as we did when we took the time to bring you the story of Pyron Solar. We will continue to forge new working alliances when we bring companies like the Hydrogen Car Company along for the ride. And the next year is the Year of the Forests, as the U.S. Forest Service looks at its 100th birthday. Together, we are uniting our voices, and I want to ask a special favor of each of you. First, thanks for listening. Continue to listen. But it's time now to bring in your friends and families into the Wild Side News community of listeners. If you're a student, invite your class to use the Wild Side News to keep informed. And if you're a visionary, come on along. And if you're a business, invest your resources in messaging, features, and sponsorships that will keep this voice of the earth loud and strong. In the year ahead, I want to hear from you. I'll be announcing some great new ways to include you in our mix. There's lots happening behind the scenes, and I can't wait to let you all in on where we go from here. So for now, we'll just have to forge ahead into our show and our second year and our future together. Thank you all for listening. In a moment, we're going to cover the breaking news about the Senate's decision on the Arctic Wildlife Refuge as we hear from Jeff Suttle, a lobbyist with the Sierra Club. Then, in our second segment, we invite you to visit the Environmental Film Festival occurring right now in the nation's capital. And in our third segment, it's into the magic and mystery of one of America's ancient villages as we visit our National Park of the Week, Bandelier National Monument. So, let's take a look at the news. The Senate yesterday defeated a measure that would have banned oil exploration and development within the 1.5 million acre Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, referred to as ANWR. The debate had been contentious and became tense near the end, as Arlen Specter cast his vote against the ban, giving the 51-49 vote victory to the Bush administration and the two Alaska Republican senators. And now to give us an up-to-the-moment briefing here from the Sierra Club is Jeff Suttle, who's a lobbyist with the Sierra Club. Jeff, give us an overview of what happened and how this ended up.
Well, today we saw a vote. The vote actually came down to 51 senators opposed to the amendment, to the Cantwell Snow Amendment. That was seeking to protect the refuge, to take refuge drilling out of the budget. We saw 51 senators oppose that measure, 49 voted in favor. The result was deeply disappointing, obviously, but we're going to continue to work with those senators. There were several senators in the middle that we know were under pressure from both sides. And we're going to continue to work with them. This is just the first round in the budget process. We're going to continue to work with them, and we're confident that as this process moves along, the American public are overwhelmingly opposed to drilling in this special place, drilling in the refuge. And we're confident that at the end of the day, we're not going to see this measure actually pass. It was a close vote. We were disappointed in the votes of several members. We're gonna continue to work with everybody that'll talk to us about this issue, because they know, every senator knows that the constituents of their state, the American people, don't want to see drilling rigs in the Arctic Refuge. This is a special place. It's too special to drill.
My impression really is that, exactly as you say, that the American public is not in favor of this. In their heart and in their soul, they really see through it. They realize that the amount of oil that's going to come from this is really not going to make much of a difference. I think the message is getting out that in reality, we're not going to see this oil in a week or two or 10 days or possibly even 10 years. So then the question becomes, what is this really all about?
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, what I'd like to point out is that even government experts, the U.S. Geological Survey, say it's the amount of oil potentially in the refuge is just a few months' worth. Even oil companies concede that it's not going to be available for another 10 years. It's going to take 10 years before we even see a first drop. But fortunately enough, it's just not going to get that far. You're absolutely right. The American public sees through this. They know, you know, I know, that there are very simple, you know, there are very simple steps that we could take today, solutions to this problem, to reduce our dependence on oil, and to invest in a cleaner, energy future. Just simple steps like inflating your tires, on your car. If every American inflated their tires, to a certain extent, we could save more oil than we would ever get from the refuge. Another step like making cars actually go farther on a gallon of gasoline, which we've seen, you know, car companies can do it. You're seeing hybrids on the streets these days. By increasing our fuel efficiency standards, we can get, we can begin to save not only more oil than we'll ever see from the refuge, we'll drastically reduce the oil that we import from all over the world.
Well, I, for one, am really hoping that at some point here we'll hop on to a concept like the Apollo Alliance and really shoot for energy independence in 10 years, because that would put millions of people back to work and change the whole nature of this. So, but here, the question I want to throw at you, and you can throw some hard balls here. This is what we're all about. The question is really, why is this such an important issue to win? And I mean, I have my own concepts, but I'd love to hear what you have to think about that.
Sure. Well, what we're talking about, this obviously, the vote today sets a poor precedent. What drilling proponents did was they snuck Arctic drilling into the budget process. That's something that it's an abuse of the process. It's inappropriate. They know they didn't have the votes to win it fair and square. They know they didn't have the votes to win it by following normal congressional procedure. So they did by using this maneuver intentionally, just in an effort to limit public debate and sneak it through the budget process, an unrelated bill that they know, you know, it's not only irresponsible drilling in the, as far as ecologically, it's fiscally irresponsible, and we're obviously deeply disappointed, but. There are folks like Tom DeLay. We've heard folks say, you know, this is about more than drilling in the refuge. This is about more than the Arctic refuge. This is about, you know, if we can drill here, we can drill anywhere. So obviously, we're concerned about not just the potential of drilling in the refuge, but drilling off the coast of Florida, for example, or drilling off the coast of California. These are very real issues that people are concerned about, that is why this issue, the Arctic Refuge, has risen to the top. I mean, it's a bellwether of where we're going to draw the line in, where we're going to draw the line in the tundra.
I heard Senator Domenici yesterday say that when this is passed, Colorado, get ready, because you've got oil in your oil shale, and that's where we'll be coming next, because that will help save us. I mean, that was quite an amazing admittance of what America can look forward to. It's extraordinary.
Well, yes, and absolutely. I think unfortunately they'll feel emboldened by the vote today, but I think proponents will soon find out. Drilling proponents will soon find out. This isn't going to get very far. This is the first step in the budget process. We obviously, later on in the year, will expect the budget as the budget resolution moves forward, where the committees will actually work to enact the laws that would change change these regulations, and ultimately in an attempt to pass the final budget. I mean, this is just one additional thing. They added one extra thing onto the budget that's going to make it less appealing for Congress, for members to pass. And they have, you know, it's members on both both sides of the aisle. It's not just Democrats. It's not just Republicans. People are concerned about deficits. They're concerned about spending. And this, the Arctic in particular is a great example of irresponsible fiscal policy. The revenues that they say we're going to get from this just don't exist. It's not there. We're not going to see the money. As a result, that puts the budget as a whole at risk, which is unfortunate because two out of the last 3 years they haven't been able to pass a budget because of budget shenanigans like this.
For people who are concerned that this may be the end, it really isn't. This is, as you say, a process. Help people understand where this will go from here now in the days ahead and then the weeks ahead.
Sure, absolutely. And this is definitely, this is by no means end game. What we're talking about is the first round of this fight. And as we move forward, the budget process, how it works is they will probably adopt this is what's called the budget resolution by the end of this week. They're looking to adopt this by the time they go into recess next week. And then later on in the year, the budget resolution goes back to the authorizing committees, such as the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. And those committees contribute to the overall budget reconciliation bill later in the year, that actually changes the tax laws and the mandatory spending programs in order to meet the targets adopted in this resolution. The resolution bill, again, is where they actually seek to change the laws that presently protects the refuge, for example. As this process moves forward, we're going to see this issue come up again in different forms, we're going to be working with the same offices that we've been working with on this vote to make sure that that this thing, this ill-conceived plan to try to sneak drilling revenues into the budget, it doesn't happen. To make sure that Congress sees this as the mistake that it is, and that the American public knows the mistake that this is to be.
What would you recommend as the most effective way for listeners and the public to assist in the process of making sure that we move forward towards sustainability and environmental health and not drilling in areas such as Anwar?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing you can do is, right off the bat, folks, what they need to do is call their senators. Find out how they voted. Look up how their senators voted. And tell them, either call them and thank them. Thanking them is just as important as telling them you're disappointed for those members that voted the wrong way. So call up your member and say, thank you so much for supporting this. It's important. And on the flip side, call up your member and say, call up your senators that didn't vote the right way and say, this is the, tell them the budget is the wrong place to do this. This is too controversial an issue to sneak through as part of the budget process. Let them know that you're opposed to this. Let them know that you care about the refuge and the other places that this puts at risk. And they can do that by actually calling the Capitol switchboard. And I have the number here. It's 202-224-3121. Again, that's 202-224-3121. And especially in the next couple days, it's really important for folks that care about these issues to weigh in with their senators, find out how they voted, and call and tell them how you feel about it.
Republican senators who voted for the amendment to protect Anwar from drilling were Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, Norm Coleman. I was quite surprised at that, but Minnesotans are fairly strong environmentalists. He's from Minnesota. Susan Collins, another person who we watch regularly, and Olympia Snow of Maine, Mike DeWine of Ohio, John McCain of Arizona, that's pretty predictable, and Gordon Smith of Oregon. Those were Republicans. And then Democrats who voted against the drilling ban were Senators Daniel Akaka and Daniel Inouye of Hawaii and Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. So that gives you some names of people that you might want to really, really pay attention to. Okay, Jeff, let's talk again here soon sometime, and let's hope that the right decisions are made for America's future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sydney.
Thanks, Jeff, for joining us here on the Wild Side News. So we've got our work cut out for us in the year ahead. And speaking about what's ahead, when we return, we're heading to our nation's capital for the Environmental Film Festival. You've got a ticket to ride on the Wild Side. So here we go, back east, and an event that has taken over the nation's capital.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
They all say, whoever they are, that a picture tells a thousand words. Well, if that's the case, then our next guest is going to introduce you to a Google of words. That's in its original sense of one followed by 100 zeros. It's the Environmental Film Fest that's happening in the nation's capital. The feature's about to begin.
If by chance you're going to be in Washington, D.C. in the days ahead through the March 20th, you're a very lucky person because the Environmental Film Festival is going on, and this is the premier Environmental Film Festival in the United States. And joining us to tell us a lot more about that is the festival's executive director, Megan Newell. Megan, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me, Sydney.
Megan, give us a little history on this film festival.
This year is our 13th year here in Washington. The festival was founded by Flo Stone, who remains on staff as our artistic director, in 1993 in order to bring people's attention to the many environmental issues in our world today and to some of the beauty of the environment, and also to bring together some of the wonderful cultural institutions in Washington, D.C. To create this collaborative program.
Now, from what I understand, the film festival is not happening in just one place. As a matter of fact, it becomes quite a social event in D.C., in the nation's capital, because the films are screened in lots of different places.
That's correct. We work with actually almost 60 organizations in Washington, showing films at about 40 different venues. As I said, we're collaborative, so we really try to get all the wonderful cultural institutions in Washington, including the Smithsonian Museums, many of the embassies, universities, the public libraries, as well as a lot of environmental organizations to work together to create this 11-day program.
Now, you have 106 films from 22 countries. That has to be exciting. What are going to be some of the most spectacular films this year?
Well, we have several different themes in the festival this year. One is food and the environment, and we have some wonderful films, documentaries, as well as short films and animated films about the connections between food and the environment. And we're also highlighting wildlife this year, so we have films on a number of different animals and wild places in the world. We also have some films on water, sort of going along with food, about access to clean drinking water and also water privatization.
Also, you work in a large film format, the IMAX format. Tell us some of the highlights of that.
Well, we have two IMAX films in the festival this year. Both will be Washington premieres. One is a collaborative production with the National Geographic. It's called Roar, Lions of the Kalahari, and it was 5 years in the making, and it's a really beautiful film that shows the majesty of lions in their natural environment. And the other IMAX film is called Coral Reef Adventure. It's a beautiful film as well that shows some of the wonderful coral reefs that are left in the world and highlights the reasons that we really need to work on saving coral reefs, because they are dying off at an unprecedented rate.
Global warming is a huge issue around the planet, and the world is awakening to the fact that it isn't just people talking. Obviously, that has to be featured in this year's films.
Yes, we had a pre-festival screening on March 1st where we showed the world premiere of a new documentary called The Great Warming, which highlights both a number of the problems related to global warming and some creative solutions that people are working on around the world. And we hope this is going to be a seminal film on the subject and that it will get a lot more play in other places, because global warming really is one of the most crucial issues facing us today. We're also showing a second film on global warming, which is made by a local filmmaker here in the Chesapeake area called We Are All Smith Islanders, that highlights some of the effects on the Chesapeake Bay area that we've already seen and are going to continue seeing if we don't do something about global warming.
Wildlife is always thrilling to see in film. One of the reasons it is because so many of us never really have a chance to see what the filmmaker can see, and they capture special moments. Talk about some of the highlights of the wildlife filmmakers this year.
We have some wonderful films. We also have some really wonderful, prestigious visiting directors. Chris Palmer, who is a very well-known environmental and wildlife filmmaker, will be giving an illustrated lecture called Adventures in Wildlife Filmmaking, talking about the many films he's made and how difficult it can be to capture wildlife on film. We also will have Tristan Baer here. He is the son of a well-known director, Wolfgang Baer, and they co-directed a new film called Earthling, which takes us around the world on a two-year journey visiting places and wildlife. In the Arctic, we see polar bears, we see orangutans in Indonesia, and some wonderful jellyfish under the ocean. We also have a great film called Walking with Ghosts, which captures the elusive lynx in Canada's boreal forest. So those are just three of the highlights of our wildlife program.
Children are welcome. Talk about some of the children's films this year.
We have 16 programs for children this year, and we always are excited about our children's programs. We have a series of short animated films on food playing at four different BC's public libraries, and we have a great new feature film from Canada called The Blue Butterfly, which is a very touching story about a young man with cancer whose last wish is to go to Costa Rica and to see the very rare blue morpho butterfly, and has a surprise uplifting ending, so I won't give that away, but the film stars William Hurt, and that will be at the National Geographic Society.
I thought it would be great to hear a clip from The Blue Butterfly, so let's take a listen.
Hey, Pete, you see this? See this flower? See this little flower? And this little beetle? They depend on each other. Beetle, pollinator, no beetle, no flower. No flower, homeless beetle.
Symbiosis.
Exactly.
Speaking of an uplifting ending, I'm just curious if you find that the films this year will tend to be more uplifting or warning. In the past, I know so many environmental films really were talking about disaster. Any sense on that?
One of our goals is to really bring the broad range of the environment to people. So we do have some issue films which are really pointing out disasters or, you know, sort of some of the things that are happening that are not so great and that people need to be aware of. But we also have some films that just showcase the beauty of the environment, the beauty of wildlife. And also, we try to bring out things like the built environment. We have two or three, I guess, this year, wonderful films on architecture and architects. And we also always try to have a few films on art and artists' take on the environment. So we hope that there, and we know that there are some uplifting stories to be found in the festival.
Talk about the art films, those done by artists. That sounds interesting.
Well, one that we have that we're really that we feel is really special this year is called The Tuharangi Contour. It's about this gigantic sculpture that was built in New Zealand that follows the contour of the land. That's showing at the National Gallery, with another wonderful film called Trees, which just has some really stunning photography of trees around the world. And it's sort of a very slow, calming film. It just has some nice music in the background and some stories about trees throughout the history of the world. So those are two of the great art films they're showing together at the National Gallery of Art.
It's really interesting the way in which you've integrated the entire community in the process of presenting this spectrum.
Flo Stone, one of her goals originally was to, you know, she saw all these great institutions to bring them all together and to bring to the public's attention the fact that there are these wonderful existing programs. Many of our programs are free, and so many of the museums in Washington are free to the public, and we like to, you know, bring that to people's attention, that there's all this great cultural goings-on that they should know about.
Now, also, a lot of the films are actually coming from around the world, and so you really are presenting as well this international vision of the state of the world. What are some of the highlights that you're finding coming from different countries?
We have a wonderful Italian film that's being sponsored by the Italian Cultural Institute at the National Geographic Society called People of Rome, and it gives a great overview just of a city environment, what Rome is like, and what the people who actually live there are like. We also have some great films from Africa. One this year is called Cosmic Africa, and it's actually sort of the story of the life of a South African astrophysicist, and he takes a look at the many African traditions surrounding the cosmos.
I understand that there are films as well from places like South Korea, and that there's some interesting interpretations of life there.
Yeah, our opening event was at the Freer Gallery of Art, and we showed award-winning films from a new environmental film festival in Seoul, Korea. All three were Korean films. We had a short fiction film about how city and development is taking over some of the natural places in Seoul, and then we also had a short documentary that showed about how a group of people were trying to save a mountain that still was existing in the middle of Seoul, and how they worked together to try and save that wild space.
Sure wish I could be there. One of the things about film is the fact that it is so effective in really telling stories and bringing these messages to life. It has to be thrilling to be part of this event.
Oh, absolutely. I always tell people I have the best job. I get to watch movies and get paid for it. But we do, film is a really wonderful way to communicate to the public about anything, but particularly the environment, because I think seeing is believing in a lot of cases. So
you're also going to have a number of lectures and talks.
Yes, we will have, as I mentioned previously, Chris Palmer will be doing an illustrated lecture. And we always try, when we can, to have filmmakers or experts come and discuss films at the end. We're showing a documentary called The Future of Food, which is part of our food theme. And at the end of that documentary, there will be a panel discussion, including the filmmaker, Deborah Coons Garcia, and a number of local experts on food issues. So those are two of the highlights. But like I said, many of the films include discussions.
Terrific. Now, coming up this weekend, what might be available for people who are in D.C.?
A number of the films I've mentioned will be playing this weekend, but one of our great highlights is two programs of films on national parks at the National Museum of American History. Will be world premiering a new film by filmmaker John Grabowska called Remembered Earth, New Mexico's High Desert, which is about the beauty of the New Mexican landscape. We also have some award-winning films from the United Nations Association Film Festival in California that are coming to our festival at American University. And on Sunday, the 20th, we have the award winners from the Wild Screen Film Festival in Bristol, England, which is one of the largest wildlife film festivals in the world, and we have seven films that all won awards there, so they're really outstanding films on wildlife.
Now, for people who are in D.C., and I know I have a lot of listeners there, if they want to contact you to find out what's going on, how can they do so?
They could give us a call at 202-342-2564, or they could visit our website. All of the program information is there at www.dcenvironmentalfilmfest.org.
We've been talking with Megan Newell, who is the executive director of the Environmental Film Fest. Megan, thanks for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me, Sydney.
I'd like to take us out with a clip from what appears to be a spectacular film for the soulful adventurer. It's called Alone Across Australia. It's a film by Australian adventurer John Muir as he records his achievement of being the first person to walk solo and unassisted across the Australian continent, accompanied only by his dog, Seraphim. So let's take a listen.
I have a tremendously powerful feeling of being alone. I wouldn't call it loneliness, but an incredible sense of being very, very much alone. To have water and to have food and to have shelter and to have companionship are very much taken for granted. And yet they're the most important things in our lives, in all of our lives, every day. And yet they're simply overlooked. Unless, of course, you're in a situation where you haven't got those things.
For all my friends in the D.C. area, have a great time this weekend. Send me some emails about your favorites. And speaking of favorites, we're about to head off to one of my all-time favorite national monuments. I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico for about 25 years, and so Bandelier National Monument was my closest member of the National Park family. It's a very special place, and when we return, we're going to take a walk back in time to the cliff-dwelling wonders of the ancient peoples whose voices continue here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's amazing how life endures, how the myriad ways we have all tried to survive tell us of the greatness of this mystery of life. We now adventure to my old stomping grounds in the hills outside Santa Fe, New Mexico, on the wondrous road to the secret birthplace of the atomic bomb. Such irony. It's Bandelier National Monument. My spirit sings when I travel back up the twisting road into the foothills of the great Hemis Mountains.
I'm delighted to welcome to the Wild Side News Darlene Kuntz, who is the superintendent at Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico, one of my favorite places. Darlene, I hear you're having a bit of a mid-March snowstorm.
Oh, we sure are. It started last night, and it's supposed to snow all day today, and the park's closed today. But the moisture is good for us up here. We really needed it, and so no one's complaining.
Bandelier is an amazing place. If you haven't visited there, I highly recommend it because it's exciting. There's lots to see and do. So, Darlene, give us a perspective of what a park visitor is going to experience when they come to Bandelier.
Bandelier is about 34,000 acres, 23,000 is designated wilderness. We have an extraordinary amount of prehistoric and historic ruins. We've got about 3,000 archaeological sites surveyed within the park itself. We've got another about 1,000 caveats along the walls. It's a tough material. It's an ash material, and it's very soft, so it allowed the Pueblo people to carve out caves. And when you come to the park, you're going to get a chance to see some of these archaeological sites, some of these caveats. Even along the main trail, you'll get an opportunity to climb some of the replica ladders that they used historically. You'll be able to see some of the larger ruins like Chione, that at one time housed about 100 people. You'll be able to see some of the artwork on the walls. And it'll just take you back kind of in time. Also to the exhibits and sometimes, you know, of cultural demonstrations in the summertime. So you can see the current local Pueblos and how they relate and how that lifestyle continues to exist.
Why did these folks come to this canyon? And then also what I'm sure everybody wants to know is why did they build the homes in the cliffs?
Frijoles Canyon is the main canyon in the park. What we've got down there is access to water. You have Frijoles Creek. It was a good climate. You had, like I said, you had that soft tuff. It's an ash that about a million years ago had volcanic eruptions and kind of created the canyons and Bandelier. And it was a tough, soft material, so people could build their caveats out of it. Also, too, they could carve their stones to build their pueblos. And it was a good site, Frijoles Canyon. They grew beans and corn, small mammals to feed on. And it was just it was a good place to raise their families, just like you and I, grow their crops, do a little bit of hunting. Climate was good. They had access to water. And so they spent some time in the area.
How are they connected with the cultures around them? their neighbors?
Kind of this whole southwest area, you know, there's a variety of pueblos and Indian tribes. So there was a multicultural, just a combination of pueblos and Indians all throughout the area. And they traded. A lot of times we'll find like points and different things, different tools and stones that they used for carving and matates for corn. And what we'll find is that stone or that material was never found in Bandelier. But it was found like maybe, you know, 50 to 100 miles from here in some sort of quarry. That they even had quarries that they would trade a lot of this material, because, you know, it was a daily thing, their lives, to use all these tools. And so you can kind of see that there was an integrated culture throughout the area.
They were very complex people, and as you say, they did have a lot of interaction. How did they relate with the Chaco culture? Because I believe that there's a relationship.
From what I understand, there was a relationship. The Chaco culture, a little bit of a different time frame than lower down here. There's still a lot of unknowns. One of my favorite things is to go out and hike with the archaeologists. And, you know, I love to ask questions and ask answers. And they're really good about saying, you know, they just don't know. We know they interacted. I'm not sure we fully understand to what depth. And then, you know, the people came and left. And a lot of times there's no indications for us at this time as to why. We know some, but there's still so much more that we don't know.
Do you know why they left? I mean, has there been some evidence perhaps that there was a drought or some sort of illness or something else?
You know, it's funny because I ask those same questions to the archaeologists, and they say, yep, you're right, it could have been any one of those things. And I don't say that lightly, because I think we all want those answers, and we don't have any kind of what we would consider today positive proof. But it could have been any one of those things. They didn't write anything down, and everything was taught or shared through stories. And, you know, sometimes even with the current Pueblos and the Pueblo people, those are very sacred stories, and so they're not always comfortable, and we totally understand that, of sharing that. So it's kind of a mystery, and it keeps us all wondering.
When a person visits Bandelier, they're going to kind of have three possible experiences. One is the canyon experience, one is the cliff dwellings, and then also there is, for those who can make it to the top of the mesa experience. Let's start with the canyon. What will people see in that canyon? Because there is a remnant of that culture there.
If you come into Chione, one of the first things you're going to do is you're going to come down into the canyon, and you're going to come into the area, you'll see all these historic stone structures. And that was built in the CCC era. We've got 33 historic structures that they came down and built at a road that you would drive down. It's a 3-mile road that takes you down into the canyon. And first thing you'll do is you'll go into the visitor center, and that's a CCC historic structure. And the CCC came in 1933 and stayed and built all these buildings in the road, and they left about 42 or so. So the first thing you'll do is you'll see those extraordinary structures. And then as you walk out the back of the visitor center, you'll get on what we call the canyon trails. And the first stop that you'll come to is Chione. And that's one of the larger Pueblo sites that we have in the park. You'll see it's kind of in a circular thing. And as you climb, as you go through the trail through the middle of the Pueblo site, it'll wind you back up towards the K-Bates. And as you look back down on Chione, you'll see that it was a circular Pueblo site with a huge courtyard center area where they would, you know, children would play and they'd have their fires. At one point, we believe it housed about 100 people. It was up to 2 to 3 stories high. And then as you follow that around, you'll see several kivas. There's a big kiva right outside Chione, and then there's several smaller kivas within the site itself.
Of course, the kivas are the underground ceremonial spaces.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct, and you'll have a good example. There's one excavated, and then you'll see a couple that haven't been excavated, but that you can kind of see the indentations into the earth itself. And there's still some mysteries about the kivas, too, in the sense that in one kiva you'll see 3 square holes in the floor, you know, probably about 6 inches deep. And still today we wonder what those holes were. Were they foot drums? Were they? Our guess is still, you know, we can only imagine. And then as you continue on up the trail, you'll go up towards the K-Bates. towards the caves on the side of the cliffs there. And the trail winds along the cliff there, and you'll have an opportunity to climb in some of these K-Bates and see the historical soot on the roofs where they had their fires. And they plastered the side of the walls to keep the from crumbling and dust and dirt. And on that plaster, they would paint their drawings. Like, you'll see serpents, and you'll see figureheads and animal heads. And then as you go along the trail, you'll look up on the cliffs, and you'll see a lot of petroglyphs along the cliffs. And then as you walk down, you'll see Longhouse, which is a long Pueblo site, and Tallis House, which is a replica of a Pueblo house. And then you'll continue down in there till Frijoles Canyon, and if you can make it, at the end of the trail, we've got about a 140-foot vertical climb up to what we call Alcove Cave. It's just this huge, huge cave where people lived. It's, you know, dug out just like the cave aids on the hill. And if you're brave enough, you can climb up the ladders, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, those ladders, for those who are willing and don't have a fear of heights or something like that, you get a chance to hop onto these ladders. They're wonderful wooden remnants, kind of an old
right.
form of ladder, and climb to the top. When you get to the top, what's the experience there?
I think the best experience there is we have a replica kiva that you can climb down in and can kind of get a feel that people would go down there and have share stories and have ceremonies. And at that time period, it was mostly the males that used the kivas. And so you can climb down in and spend a few minutes and see how, and feel how cool it is that, you know, in the heat of the summer and how warm it is in the wintertime. And the Alcove Cave, it's just a wonderful place just to sit. You can look up and down the canyon. You can look down and on the other Pueblo sites. And you can just let your imagination go wild about what life was like, you know, around 12 or 1300.
Yeah, that's very romantic. What's the best season to visit?
Spring, summer, and fall. Probably July and August, the monsoons come in, so unless you, you know, which is kind of nice because it just, you know, it's real hot during the day and then the rains come in and it kind of cools it off and they come through pretty fast, so even that time of year is not bad. You just get a different experience, but I'd say spring and fall.
What would be some of the closest landmark towns and cities that people might be familiar with?
You'd come out of Santa Fe and you'd head north, and then you could come through either White Rock or Los Alamos, and then you would come into the park on Highway 4.
Which is an extraordinarily beautiful drive.
It is. It's a state scenic byway, and if you come up Highway 4 through White Rock, and you just really get a feel for the area. All the cliffs that you look along the walls, once you get out of Santa Fe and you start coming up the mountains, you can see these caves, and you can see some of the petroglyphs, and you can see the soot if you look in the caves, and you know that people lived all along in this area.
Now, you've got some interesting new developments with Bandelier. Number one, you're looking at your 90th anniversary.
Yep, in February of 1916, the park was established. It was run by the Forest Service for a number of years. Roughly till around, I want to say, early 1930s. And then the Park Service took it over at that time. Next year, we're 90 years old. And in 2016, we'll be 100 years old, the same centennial of the National Park Service. So next year what we've got planned is we've got events planned like on a monthly basis, and everything will be on the website, and we're going to do stuff like, you know, we're working now with maybe even establishing a limited edition Pendleton blanket or some sort for Bandelier, and just all sorts of things that people can come and kind of get a, you know, just have a good experience. That's what it's all about.
One of the things that we both share a passion for, and that is the artifacts that you'll find. And, of course, all of the national parks do have these extraordinary collections that generally aren't open to the public because they're very valuable and historic and irreplaceable. But you're doing something very fascinating, and I'm so thrilled to hear about this, and that is an online experience for people to be able to become familiar with the extraordinary collections at Bandelier.
What we've done is we just unveiled last week, we've done a program, it's a kind of a national program for the Park Service. We're trying to get out to the parks and come with, you know, really highly qualified photographers and, you know, some help us with some script writing and developing a whole website that is really just focused on the collections at Bandelier. So what they've done, we've got about 150 items on the website of prehistoric and historic and modern objects that we have in our collection, like you said, that we're unable to share with the public on a regular basis. We've got Pablito Velarde paintings, we've got Hummer paintings, we've got pots, we've just got a whole gamut of things. There's you can look through the pictures, you can get on and interact with some music and stories. There's lessons plans that if you're a teacher that you can pull off and teach about museum collections and within your classroom. And so what it's done is it's just given the public who really, need to see this stuff an opportunity to do that. So if you're anyone from just, a visitor that wants to look to someone that wants to study, I think the site will be really good.
The site is up now, and how can people find that site?
The easiest site is to go on nps.gov, go to the National Park Service, pick up Bandolier, and right on there you'll see one of the biggest icons for the museum collection. You can hit on that and it'll take you right in there.
That's exciting. So that's nps.gov, and then when you go there, you'll be able to choose from the park list and go to Bandolier.
Yes.
Is there camping at the park?
We've got two campgrounds. We've got a group campground, and then we've got more of a family campground. We've got 70 miles of backcountry trails, and you can backcountry camp. You need a permit. We just put you in zones so we can spread you out. But once you get in the backcountry, that is what, or just off on some of our trails outside of the canyon, that is what I think is so exciting, too, because you walk along and there's just all these Pueblo sites, archaeological sites out there. You know, of course, we ask people not to take anything or walk on them. But it's just, you know, it's just an extraordinary thing to walk among this, and you'll see all sorts of sizes and shapes of sites. And still, it's just amazing. Last fall, just a visitor was hiking in an area of the park and found a whole bean pot, and we thank him because he called the park, and we've made it part of the collection, and learning more about it, we can share it with folks. So I really want to encourage people to visit the canyon, but not just that, is to pick up a trail map and try to get off the beaten path.
That experience in that part of New Mexico would be wonderful. The silence that you experience in that place is unique, and the skies are the bluest of any place in North America.
We still have great night skies, too.
That's true.
A lot of places in the park. And
yeah, you can see 100 bazillion stars every single night.
Right.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous place.
I've worked a lot of places. It's my ninth move with the Park Service. And you know, I've enjoyed every one of them tremendously. But something about Bandolier, and it's just its culture and its history and all the artifacts and the sites and stuff, it kind of humbles you when you're out there. And your imagination just seems to go crazy.
My experience has been the sense that this was a gentle people.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it feels to me.
Mm-hmm.
People who sort of had a life that they had control of, they understood it. It's one of my favorite places, what can I say? I love Bandolier.
I think you just did a great job of describing it.
Well, listen, I want to thank Darlene Kuntz, the superintendent at Bandolier, for joining us on the Wild Side News. I encourage everybody to get a chance to visit, if not Bandolier, then one of the Pueblo parks, because the experiences there are quite unique, and there's a phenomenal story of early American, Native American history that we need to know a lot more about because it's part of American history as well. Thanks, Darlene, for being on the Wild Side News.
Hey, thanks, Sydney.
It's all a part of history, and we make our own historic mark here on the Wild Side News as we finish our first year and head on out to the unknown. What will this next year bring? We'll just have to wait till next time to find out. Until then, this is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Join me next week as the voice of the earth continues, or anytime on our archives, always on the Wild Side News.